Podcast Talk by Gamma, keeping you connected and protected.
Welcome to DAS Talk, the essential podcast on distributed antenna systems and in-building communication. Hosted by Peter, VP of Gamma, and Philip Nicholas. This Gamma Electronics series focuses on emergency response and safety. Join us as we navigate the challenges of building effective communication systems for North America's first responders. We delve into the advancements in emergency responder radio systems and the transformative impact on new technologies. Tune in for insightful discussions aimed at increasing knowledge and awareness in the DAS field. Whether you're a professional or an enthusiast, DAS Talk is your gateway to understanding the nexus of technology, safety, and communication.
Hey, everybody. My name is Philip Nicholas. We are here at DAS Talk. I am with my co-host, Peter, the VP of Gamma, and our guest, Kevin Kurz from Westel. Hey, Peter, take it away.
Hey, guys, again. Philip, thanks for spearheading this thing. And Kevin, it's great to see you today and chat with you again. I believe we've met before at IWCE or another trade show in the past where we've got to meet each other face to face. It's good to see you again this morning. And thank you for being with us. I know that you've got an extensive background and history in this. You've got your 27-year-old veteran who started in cellular communications, aka Cellular One. You worked with AT&T, you worked with T-Mobile on the West Coast, and later worked for Master Agents in Cellular Communications. You've been in the distribution and OEM world since 06, and you worked with major distributors, manufacturers to promote cellular public safety antenna systems, which I love talking about. So I'm assuming you're here because you like to do it too.
Absolutely. I want to thank you both for having me. It's an honor to be on your podcast. And as you chronicled some of the things I've done, it's been an amazing ride and hope to have many, many more years helping people out. And both on the cellular background that I had, more focused on public safety solutions now. So I'm happy to be here.
Sure. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the cool achievements that you've done, or what are some of the fun things you've worked on in your public safety and or cellular background? Because really, we're gonna mold the two and talk about how they come together today. But go ahead and tell us a little bit about what
absolutely.
You've done.
Absolutely. It was kind of really interesting how I started in the industry working for Cellular One's Craig McCaw. And I did that to launch Cellular One. A few years later, we were purchased by AT&T, and then I was with them for about 4 or 5 years and had the opportunity to launch T-Mobile, which was fantastic. There was a divestiture of Deutsche Telekom that was going on, and so I was able to manage all of the dealers. There was about 700 of them up and down the West Coast, and what a great time to be in the industry. I was learning how to do rate plans, met with the Public Utilities Commissions, to be able to see how that process is. You don't just invent a rate plan and then just start selling it. It needs a lot of approvals. And as I kind of went through my career, I started to get more involved in public safety. Some of the fun wins I had in the cellular world were doing a lot of, national stadiums. I worked on Falcon Stadium, also Yankee Stadium, and several others. And to know just from a financial standpoint what that meant to the wireless operators to not have any dead zones in those bowls. As many know, the signal towers can't get into those bowls, right? They can't get over the parapet of the top wall of the highest bleacher. And so those solutions need to be very robust. Worked with every OEM in the cellular space. They were very fortunate to do that for almost 15 years. And coming from a blue family, most of my relatives are detectives and homicide investigators. I just always grew up with that. And when I first heard about, obviously RF project, you can do the same with public safety. So that's kind of where I started to do both. Fortunately, I was in a Southeast region position where I could sell both public safety and cellular. And, as we kind of talk more about the details of what we need to do to help building owners, make sure their customers are safe. The number one thing we have to remember is it's more important to think early on about the ability to dial 911. So cellular enhancement in the building is really crucial, because if you don't have that and you have, cut to the building's power, you're going to need to be able to dial 911 from something, and you're going to need to rely on your cell phone. And that's how the first responders are going to first know there's an issue.
But I've thought about some of the things you just brought up. So you've got Yankee Stadium, you've got Falcon Stadium, you've got multiple different stadiums. Let's talk about that just for a second here, because I think maybe for someone who's trying to understand why is it so important. So if I've got a cell phone and you're saying my cell phone wouldn't normally work inside one of those stadiums unless you guys put in, did what to it? What would you have to do it?
Yeah. So, you know, starting at the beginning on that, Peter, is, you know, fan experience is so important to the wireless operator. Public safety does enter into it as well. Obviously, we're putting thousands of people in a spectator, you know, place where we want to make sure that everyone's safe. But basically, the construction materials of a stadium, there's a lot of concrete and steel. So these are RF propagating blockers, right? So you need to definitely make sure that you have a donor antenna high up on the stadium that can be pointed at the local cellular tower or public safety, radio tower, whatever it is. And then have the right azimuth so that you're making sure that you're working with a wireless operator that you can handle the traffic. Everything from a fan perspective is they want to go to the stadium. They want to make sure they can order their food. You know, there's so many cool apps that the stadium owners have put in place. And you're just not going to have good signal unless you have really robust service antennas around that particular arena. So we've seen just a lot of stadiums and sport owners solve that problem to really kind of chase at having the best experience possible. And then you start to look at the parking deck to these particular venues. I don't know if you've personally experienced this, but when you go to leave a stadium sport, it could take you 45 minutes to an hour to get out of the parking deck, get on the roads, and get to your home. So there's been some really cool apps that will actually tell you as you're going up the top of that parking deck where the empty spaces are. And there's some really cool technology, some wireless technology that actually counts the spaces that are open, even to the point where, you know, a restroom break. You know, you might be at the game for 3 hours. Which restrooms have the shortest wait times, right? So there's a lot of really cool apps that drive revenue in for the wireless carrier that become a part of the solution.
So I see this as a safety. I see this as a safety issue too, right? So, I mean, you've got thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of people stuffed into these stadiums. And not only do they need to have a good fan experience where they're, you know, able to record themselves, post it online, they couldn't normally do that without a robust cellular system installed in the building with the right donor antennas pointing at the local towers like you talked about, right? But on the other hand, if something goes down, because if I was a bad guy, I mean, it seems like that might be a good place to do some stuff. Or maybe if it was just a fight breaks out and they need to communicate in and out of the stadium, they've got to be able to do that, right? So I see it as a safety issue as well, to be able to communicate with their cell phones in and out of the stadium.
Absolutely. So you're really touching on, Peter, interoperability, right? For, you know, things such as FirstNet, when something really does happen where multiple agencies need to communicate on one channel to be able to coordinate an event. And then you also have preemptive dialing. So one thing we take advantage as consumers is that we're just going to be able to dial a number, whether it be a 10-digit number or long distance 911, a 7-digit number. And I believe it was Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, that incident was the very first time that Verizon and AT&T used preemptive dialing. And so what that means is they're able to shut off consumer traffic and only leave traffic open for the first responder. And imagine there being an incident in a stadium environment during a Sunday game. Everybody's going to be dialing 911. People are going to be calling their loved ones. It's going to immediately tax the system. And we've seen in previous incidents where that radio tower or that cell site tower could be overcapacitated. So that's something that FirstNet's helping with. We also have the ability to, like I said, preemptive dialing so that the first responders get first priority to be able to utilize their two-way radios and their cellular phones to get planning together to make, you know, to respond to an incident.
So, okay, so maybe that's what happened to me this one time, because I'm in California and we're prone to earthquakes here. And I don't know if the earthquakes, maybe you can elaborate on this a little bit, but in an emergency situation, my cell phone was not dialing out whatsoever. An earthquake had happened And shortly thereafter, so either the earthquake had an impact on the cell towers, or I felt like it was just so many people were trying to dial, because it was a pretty, there was a lot of stuff that happened. I mean, there were, I remember a bookshelf had fallen over in my house. It was in the location of Diamond Bar at the time. And there were some people's structures that had gotten damaged. And so people were kind of freaking out. A lot of stuff was going down. I felt like it was the overload of everyone calling 911 at the same time. No, there was no cell phone communication whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what happens. I mean, these cell sites and two-way radio towers could get overcapacitated. One thing that's important to note in what you just mentioned, too, is if you look at any metropolitan area, there could be hundreds, if not thousands, of bidirectional amplifiers. And Westel's gear, as well as some of our competitors, we have the ability to do automatic gain control. So when there are incidents like that, the bidirectional amplifier can power down until the interference is over, and then it automatically knows to power back up when the problem goes away. So, you know, just what you just described is really important. It will happen. Usually when you do see incidents with, you know, unfortunately in our country, we have an amount of active shooters at the K-12 that, you know, when those particular smaller communities have everybody dialing, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the traffic just goes through the roof, and a lot of times technology can't keep up with it. So it's really important for the wireless carrier. Yeah.
Yeah. Uvalde was an example of that, where you've got active shooters. And how does this tech help out, for example, school districts and campuses? I mean, we're talking a lot about, you know, people communicating. Let's turn a little bit towards emergency responders, because that's what really the focus of this is, even though the cell phone communication is important as well. But how does this tech help out, for example, campus safety? Let's talk through K-12.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been fortunate to work on probably 300 or 400 school districts, actually schools within school districts in my career. And the one thing is, and we talked about, you know, often in this industry, is awareness, right? A lot of the stakeholders at the school level, superintendents obviously know that this solution exists, but an emergency responder communication enhancement system is going to capture really good, adequate signal at the roof. And it's going to come down from that donor antenna. The donor antenna has got to be tuned for the proper frequency. It's going to come down with some coaxial cable to a bidirectional amplifier. That amplifier is going to take the situation of the outdoor signal, and it's going to amplify the signal, and it's going to redistribute the signal through a series of service antennas. That is known as the link budget. So there is a software program that many integrators use that's kind of the de facto in our industry. That's called IBWave. And what the IBWave calculations do is create sort of a heat map from the existing floor plans to see the signal coming in. A link budget actually calculates how many antennas is needed to cover the proper floor and each individual area. And you want to really come out with ubiquitous coverage. And then keep in mind, this is all driven by code in the public safety. So we know a lot of our metropolitan areas wind up with knowledge in and around the code, and they've been on the forefront of it. Many schools have already put these systems in. But you also look at, you know, education and you know, meetings that we have with Safer Buildings Coalition and other to increase awareness for the counties that aren't enforcing yet, right? So you'll hear a term thrown around called AHJ, and that stands for Authority Having Jurisdiction. That's 9 times out of 10 going to be your fire marshal. So Peter, going back to the school scenario, that particular district might not be seeing, there's a difference between mandate and enforcement. Mandates have been around for many, many years in the code, but certain jurisdictions are actually enforcing the code. And that's what we're really looking to focus on, is the companies and jurisdictions that are enforcing the code. And that could be a large high rise for education, could be a multi-building campus, or could be commercial property. It depends on where that fire marshal sees the threat and what buildings they're going to enforce. And that's really important to kind of think about when you think about K-12. Because these schools are built, some of them in the 1950s and 60s. They don't have a lot of windows. They're made with a lot of dense concrete block. So propagation of that radio tower, it might get around the parking lot and the external areas of that building. But more often than not, they're not getting in every classroom, hallways, lunchrooms where these incidents happen.
So real quick, tell Kevin, you're the pro here. Tell our listeners what propagation means.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when you look at RF, resonant frequency, there is a lot of RF blockers. So it could be the topography of where the tower is, depending on where the school is, for example, if there's not really good line of sight. And even if there is good line of sight, you have a lot of rebar and concrete, a lot of maybe areas that are really treed, you know, where the signal might be great in the winter when the leaves have fallen off, the deciduous trees have shed their leaves, but then summertime, the density of that foliage might block the signal getting in. So propagation, and also too, think about the density of a building, right? If there's a lot of concrete wall, inner walls versus sheetrock, you know, the signal's not going to penetrate as well. So we do have to look at every single project as a one-off. There's no cookie cuttering to emergency responder communications. The moment that an integrator or a stakeholder will try to cookie cutter, you're going to have problems. You really need to respect the venue and take a look at every individual venue to make sure that you're doing the design justice. There's proper techniques with the integrator that they must follow. And really, I'd be remiss if I didn't say how important it is to work with the authority having jurisdiction. And there's another stakeholder called the frequency license holder. And they're actually the ones that own the license to the frequency. And it's illegal to propagate and enhance and amplify signal without the frequency license holder's permission. So, you know, these are all education pieces, Peter, for the people that are engaging on finding out what their systems might cost. Start everything out with a budgetary process to make sure that the budget is going to meet, you know, the solution that we're suggesting. I've worked with a lot of people that have a $50,000 budget, but the building's going to cost $300,000. So it's real important to level, you know, level understand early.
Yeah. Well, that's a big difference.
That was most successful. Yeah.
So, because, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I attended school in Amityville, which is a school on Long Island. And the schools on Long Island, this was a high school and middle schools, versus where I live now in California, the school footprints and plans are like night and day. You can probably jump from, it's just sort of a style that they had. Back then, they built the schools very more compact, and they built them in higher levels. So they would stack them with, you know, three, four levels. Whereas in California, where I am at now, a lot of the schools are actually one level, and they're all spread out. And I'm thinking in my mind, while you're bringing up some of this non-cookie cutter kind of application for these designs, I would see it being, you know, a very different challenge to go from one type of building like that and another type of building. So you probably can't just drop in some cell boosters and call it a day. Is that what you're saying there? You know, you can't just or sell some boosters and call it a day like we're talking about, right? So what would be the design challenges between two different types of floor plans like that?
Yeah, that's a good point. So one of the things that the IBWave software helps you with is you start off first looking at the shape of a building. You're also looking at the materials, you know, construction materials that make it up. But a U-shaped building, for example, that might have a large courtyard in the center, that you know, represents a little bit harder challenge to design and come out with if it's just a rectangular building. So absolutely, you know, the number of floors, square footage per floor, how often you're going to put an antenna, that's going to come out of the design tool. If you have, to your point, Peter, if you have a very open airplane kind of hangar open feel, you're not going to need as many antennas. And then, of course, ceiling height is going to impact you. So one thing that we look at is trying to keep an open mind to the floor plan. We develop our partners, I should say, the integrators that work with Westel. They work with our budgetary designs to get an idea of what I would say an 85% build looks like for a budgetary proposal to the client, right? So there will be a little bit of pad on the equipment. Obviously, the integrator will do their labor, and that'll go in as a budgetary quote. And what I like about that is if a public safety solution is going to cost $30,000, and that's what we budget, And then when the integrator goes in to do the final walk, they're actually now in the building. They're using a spectrum analyzer. They're doing some testing with an antenna. More than likely, because of the way we've done the initial budgetary, the price might only be $26,000. What we try not to do to customers is tell them $26,000 and then, you know, work with change orders, or now we're in the building with the integrator, it's going to be more. So the nice thing about IVWave, it allows you to really kind of have a prudent approach to where you think the antennas are going to be. You get that budgetary approval, then the integrator is going to get permission to go into that school or, you know, group of schools and do the particular final testing. One thing is important to know, you'll have like maybe 15, 20 buildings in a district. Some of the buildings are built, you know, all at the same time. So they might use the same construction materials, but that's not good enough, because think about the school location. They may be another 4 miles away from that public safety tower. So there's all these different things that you need to take into comparison to keep an open mind that each building does, you know, deserve that design time. I've seen schools that are very open. To your point, out in California, the schools have very big open floor plans. You don't need as many antennas, and the signal propagates a lot easier. Those particular venues are going to be a little cheaper to do, right? They're not as dense. So
what do you think are some of the biggest obstacles for schools? Because we've got a few things. You've got national code, you've got state code, and you've got enforcement, right? So on a bare minimum, what are you familiar with the national code in regards to these emergency responder communication enhancement systems? And what does it say about just like sort of the basics? Tell me a little bit about that, about the national code
and NFPA, like National Fire Protection Association, was one of the ones that has the code that we draw to. There's also the IFC. Usually, depending on what part of the country you're on, they might be enforcing IFC versus NFPA. So you definitely want to look at the code, and the beauty of the integrators that are in this space, and hopefully the ones that are getting into the space, is they'll understand the importance of the code. There's now testing called NICET testing. That is something that we're hoping authorities having jurisdiction are going to start, enforcing integrators to at least be NICET certified. Safer Buildings Coalition's done a NICET book to make sure. There's just so much going on in the public safety from a code perspective that oftentimes we're asked at these seminars Safer Buildings Coalition does questions that don't have a black and white answer. Our number, one thing to say to them, well, it depends, right? It depends on, ooh, what frequencies that might be coming into that particular building, what version of the code. The one thing that's important to note is the code books are done every few years, but the fire teams and the fire marshal, in particular jurisdiction, might be a few code books behind. So it's important that you understand every little piece of it before you get started. And that's the important part, I think, of the ERCE's community, is that we understand that this solution is to save lives. We can't really mess around with that, right? We got to make sure that everything is understood and there's no assumptions made. And so when you start getting into the code, yeah, go ahead.
So for a school district, right, as superintendent, who's like, you know what, we don't have the systems put in, but I really want to, and he's got to try to figure out kind of like a budget. I imagine a budget would be probably the biggest challenge to put one in areas where he doesn't, even though what you're saying is there's national code that probably says I've got to have one of these in, and maybe even state code. On the other hand, these aren't new buildings. Are they usually grandfathered in that they don't have to have them, or what is the law saying, and what is it saying? For me, it's the same. Well, I have to get them in by a certain date, or what's going on with that?
Yeah, that's a great, great point you bring up, Peter. So I was raised in Florida. I know you had said you went to school down there. One of the things that I think is important is you get into a situation where it is county, it is fire marshal, but then when you look at the state of Florida, they were really the ones that went out first to actually do their own state statute to enforce at the state level. So you have thousands of projects that are in need of being done by the end of this year. There's actually a state statute in Florida that talks about you know, multiple dwelling units and certain floors that have to be done before you get your certificate of occupancy. And to your question, it's mostly been what I would call greenfield, you know, not really brownfield project enforcement. It's all new construction, right? Because if you look at the amount, that tens of thousands of buildings in Florida, if you tried to enforce brownfield existing buildings, you'd be probably 25 to 30 years into this, and we would need probably 100 times more integrators than we have. And so that's a real problem. But most of the enforcement you see, you know, states like Michigan and others, they enforce at the county level. There's more talk about enforcing at the state level, but it all has to be done in conjunction with proper coordination that particular authority having jurisdiction has stakeholders in place, you know, buildings, whether they be airports or transportation hubs that they see as a first, you know, group of buildings that need to be done. For me, what I've seen in the industry mostly is it's multiple dwelling units, you know, condominiums, townhouses, high rises like that, that are really seeing the majority of the code talk, if you will, as far as being able to be enforced. One thing that's unfortunate for our industry is, you know, there is a lot of safety incidents around active shooter. We've seen post offices, we've seen warehouses, we've seen schools, we've seen airports. You know, we don't know where the next incident is going to be. So to just go out and do greenfield buildings is a little problematic in my mind, because, you know, maybe the next shooting that happens is at a, you know, existing legacy college, right, where they don't have a public safety DAS in place. And there's really nobody at the local level that's enforcing them to put it in. So I think that's really the future need that we have, is to look at high target venues that might be a problem. But there's so many more incidents that happen. Years ago, I was in Charlotte Airport. This is a great story. Waiting to get on a plane. And there was an 80-year-old woman that her granddaughter had only given the boarding pass to her over her cell phone. And she was a little bit technically deficient, and her battery was beeping. And she panicked. She was worried she wasn't going to get on the plane. And so I went over and you know, I told her, hey, if you just go up to the desk, they can print you a boarding pass. And she was in the process of doing that when she had a grand mal seizure. And she fell over like a domino, almost in my arms. And I knew to call 911. I know that the American Airlines staff was doing their best on their radios to call for help. But the people around me that were dialing 911, it just seemed like maybe those 911 calls weren't routed properly. And this is about 10 years ago. And so when I called 911, the first thing I said is what terminal I was at, what gate I was at, and to make sure I educated the person that was answering my call that it was at the Charlotte airport. And so what happens is triangulation sometimes on 911, maybe it went to the city of Charlotte, right? So I immediately got transferred to the Charlotte airport police that sent their EMTs in. And I do believe we saved our life. And so it's not just active shooter. It could be anything. It could be fire. It could be you know, just so many different things. We want to make people feel safe inside. And that really starts with making sure that the signal quality is good for any type of incident that might happen.
So from what you're saying, we've got a really long, long way to go here. Because what I mean by that is, if you're talking about green or new building construction, seems like maybe you can tell me, in most major metropolitan areas, it's being enforced in the new buildings. They're requiring the emergency responder systems to be put in. But in the old buildings, we've got thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands around the nation that don't have them. And if there's an attack, you've got a big problem. So one thing we spoke with North Carolina, General North Carolina, he was an AHJ down there, and he said that first responders there, currently what they do is they need to know the layout of the towns that they're working with, and they need to know the buildings that they're going into and how to approach the buildings in order to communicate. And this kind of blew my mind for a second here. So when he sends out a squad, they had a squad leader, he would send out a squad leader, and they would go to a building. If they didn't have an emergency responder communication enhancement system in the building, they would have to take a different approach in how they would position their people to communicate properly within the building. That's crazy to me. Why that's so crazy to me is because that means when you hire on, you bring new people, you've got to acclimate them to the city about where they're going. And if they don't know the building, they can get their guys can get lost in the building. What I mean by lost is not like lost that they don't know where they are. But what I mean is like lost with communications, and they would just have no way to communicate out of the building. So we revert back to this kind of common thread here. It's like, okay, well, new buildings seem to be taken care of, but old buildings are certainly not even on the map in most places. And you mentioned another point as far as having enough integrators to do old buildings or brown buildings, is what you refer to. We're not even close to hitting that target of what we would need to have the labor or the resources to do that. So we're a very, very, very long ways off for getting our buildings as safe as where we'd want them at this point in time. We're not even close.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Peter. And one thing I would say, I've been pleasantly surprised and elated by some of the authorities having jurisdiction across the country that realize what their responsibility is and understand the new building versus existing legacy building. And I have seen many AHAs that will actually see a building that's existing and consider the threat aspect of that building and actually go and communicate with that building owner. So it really comes down to awareness of the AHA to make their community safe and to really give fair due respect to those, you know, existing venues that exist, especially when testing can be done for, you know, pretty affordable a rate from so many system integrators. When you look at the type of buildings that are dense, you know, block walls, not a lot of windows, topology has a big deal to do with it. And so going and testing those buildings, most recently, about a year or two ago, there was a university system that was kind of interesting topology in Tennessee. And the buildings that we thought were going to fail didn't. And the buildings that we thought would be fine did. And it really came down to construction materials and densification. But really what it meant to me was, you know, those existing buildings, you know, were built a lot, you know, even now, I think there's a debate on whether a new building that might be, you know, LEED certified, right? 97% of LEED certified buildings, it's great. You get the grant, you know, you get the HVAC, you know, it's going to be a lot easier to run when you've got the windows tinted from the outside, like a big high rise, let's say in downtown Atlanta. But you can almost guarantee that high-rise building, 97% of the LEED certified silver, platinum, gold, they don't propagate RF. So you almost know going in that you're going to need a public safety DAS system. So, I mean, we could take this conversation in so many different ways, but I think we need to look at legacy buildings more than we have. And I think a lot of HAs are realizing that now.
So maybe a good way to look at that would be to say we need to evaluate the kind of threats that these buildings could be. Now, not the building itself, but like a target per se, or maybe, I don't know, because you kind of look, there's different types of threats, right? So there's people inside the building who can't communicate out, right? And then there's first responders who need to get in and communicate once they get in. But maybe the way to look at it is from a law enforcement point of view, right? And say, okay, which ones are the worst targets? Because we've got, I know as a nation, we've got to do a better job at locking down our high target areas, right? Because this is never going to go away. Active shooting events are never going to stop at any point in time in the near future, right? So, but what we could do is do a better job at making our kids safer, making young adults who go to school safer in one way or another. And I think this would be a good step in the right direction, right? At least to be able to communicate properly with law enforcement with inside these buildings. So if you've got thousands of brown buildings or old buildings that don't have these systems in here, this would be like maybe the first step we could go in that direction. Say, you know what? If you're an AHJ, think about a little bit about your region. I know you're requiring all the new buildings. We've got law that says that, but what about all your legacy buildings? And maybe you should consider looking at these buildings and saying, it's a really good idea. We even lobby to get a law passed that says, well, we need to start integrating, no pun intended, right? Integrators, integrating these systems into these old buildings and do it in a way that's not so burdensome to the building owner, right? In other words, you want to do it because I also feel like there's a big problem there too. So if we make these systems so robust and so ridiculous, it's better to have a system versus no system in there like you're talking about. So if we can do something on legacy buildings that helps them get some communication in through most of the building, at a reasonable price versus, well, okay, we need 97% coverage or 99% coverage everywhere. We got to balance that kind of weight out too, right? But at the same time, we should look at it. Like you're saying, I think that's a big problem and we should really consider it.
And one thing we really didn't touch on either, and this really goes to K-12 and higher education, is often talk about budget, right? So a lot of the people mm-hmm. that need these solutions have no idea how much they cost. And every building's different, like I mentioned. So, you know, you could have a system that's 30, 40 cents a square foot. Maybe another building that's very dense could be $75 to $1 a square foot. So understanding cellular DAS versus public safety is important. Cellular DAS, my experience has been, you put the signal where the people are. Public safety DAS is you're putting the signal in back corridors, fire pump rooms, elevator corridors, places that might not have people, but where the first responders are going to be during an incident, whether it's fire incident. One thing I want to point out too, you know, growing up in South Florida, and we see this out west too, is the amount of hurricanes that we see every season is actually tolling up over the last 5 or 6 years. It seems like, you know, it's from a tropical perspective going through the Gulf of Mexico, the storms are stronger, right? So Westell has a wind rated donor antenna that's good till about 100 miles an hour, right? So we've seen so many donors just fly off a roof in the middle of a hurricane, right? So the donor antenna is gone. You've got no public safety system. So there's so many different aspects to think about. You know, one thing I've said my whole career is the code talks a lot about, you know, 2-hour fire rated coax, right? And certain jurisdictions have enforced that. You know, if it's a fire, the antennas are made out of plastic, right? What does that say about the signal that the first responders need when, you know, if it's a fire, the antennas might melt? So it's just thinking through everything and really knowing what rooms in a venue need it. You will see, you know, 99% coverage needed in the code for 95% of the area. Neg 95 signal, it's very clear. The code, you know, if you take a moment to read the code book, you can work with the authority having jurisdiction, making sure your frequency license holder is notified. You have the proper approvals before you deploy that system. And then there's system testing that you're going to do with the authority having jurisdiction off, so that when you know you turn that BDA on, the people in that building and any visitors and guests that come in will have this concern of not being protected. It will have been dealt with. And I think the one thing that's real big with public safety that we need to understand more on is these systems are designed, regardless of what manufacturer you go with, they're designed to grow as you go, right? So for a school district that's going to be putting in portables, for example, you know, you can utilize single mode fiber to run out to the portables and have remotes out there, you know, and antenna systems out there. So it really does work more toward a corporate environment and multiple buildings on one plot of land, for example. And we just need to get smarter about how we get the signal from one building to the other. And fiber helps us with that. So you don't need an individual BDA at every.
Yeah. Okay, so when you say BDA, we're talking about the amplifier that goes inside the building that grabs a signal from and then spreads it at a robust rate throughout the building and also sends it back out of the building so to the tower so the tower can grab it and the first responders, the law enforcement, can communicate, right? When you say BDA. Okay.
That's exactly it. So public safety,
okay.
Yeah, public safety is always done off air. It can be done differently, but most of the time it's off air with the donor attached to the bidirectional amplifier. It's when you get beyond about 300,000 to 400,000 square feet on multiple buildings that you need to use an optical master unit, an optical interface, to convert the coax to fiber so that you can run out to remotes that are out in the various areas of the building. If it's a large building or if it's multiple buildings, you put remotes at those other buildings. So with our system, we can do up to 3.5 million square feet with our fiber DAS. So that accomplishes, you know, multiple buildings, let's say on a university campus.
I see. Very good. Okay. So just one more question for you, Kevin. So what do you think is the biggest challenge that this industry faces in the intermediate future? We'll kind of close out with that. What do you think is the biggest challenge that we've got?
I appreciate you guys having me on. Thanks again. That's a very easy question for me to answer. I would have said budget, but the way you asked the question kind of put me in a different realm. Budget is an issue, and I hope that we do see some federal budget into the states, especially as our universities and schools. But the biggest challenge that I see is not having enough integrators, and some of the integrators that are doing just lousy work. There is a phenomenal amount of great integrators that know what they're doing. You know, I spent some time selling signal boosters with another outfit, and they're very important to smaller spaces. But when you start to talk about public safety, where you know that building inhabitants, first responders, faculty, administrators are, you know, in a situation where their lives could be in danger if those first responders couldn't communicate. We need to make sure that we get a lot more integrators schooled up how to do things the right way. There's many agencies that can help along that path. I know of several integrators that have no worries to kind of do some on-site training of electrical and construction firms to just educate, not worried that that company is going to put a store, you know, a mile down the way and compete with them. One thing that most people that have been in this industry will agree with me on is there's plenty of work for all of us. There's just too many venues that need this solution, and we just do not have enough integrators. So that would be my concern for the next 10 years, is that we can interest more companies to get into the space and to do it right.
Awesome. Fantastic. Great points of view and great conversation. Absolutely amazing. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time. I think your input is very valuable. Appreciate having you here.
Yes, thank you both so much. And go ahead.
Thank you, Kevin. Yeah. Where could we find more information on you and your company?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's just www. And from our website, there's white papers. There's all kinds of information. There's data sheets on the gear. There's some drawings to show you how all the pieces fit together, whether it's fiberglass or just an off-air. And we do have on our website, if you look under the solutions tab, we have a whole campaign talking about K-12 and higher education that I think a lot of people will find very handy and very educational.
Awesome. Thank you very much for your time, your education, everything that you're doing for the industry. And we're thankful for having you on Das Talk.
I appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
Das Talk by Gamma, keeping you connected and protected.